Welcome to another edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. Glad you could join us. Don't forget to subscribe to the Third Opinion Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Mike Deason and Lorene Jaffe have a great show for you today with discussions of the anti-Semitism that crops up in Mary Trump's new book about the president's family and so much more. So let's get right to it. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whatever time you're listening to us. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are with us. There's a lot of breaking news. We're recording this on Friday, and it just came out that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has cancer again. She's being treated for it, and she was in the hospital. She's out of the hospital. But that's upsetting. She's an icon on the court in the Jewish community, and we only wish her well. But she did say that she said she would stay on the court as long as she is physically and mentally able to handle cases. And she said, "I am fine." In fact, she and John Roberts wrote the most opinions in this past session of the court. So I guess she's moving on. She's a fighter. She really is. Did you ever see that movie? You know, you're the movie maven.
Oh yeah, the RBG movie.
Oh man, that was.
It's awesome. And she's like, you know, look, she is a hero, you know, of women's rights, of civil rights. And I will say, you know, I mean, I remember she was in the hospital earlier this week and they had let her out. But I mean, look, this woman has miraculously fought against 2 bouts of pancreatic cancer, which is a cancer that like almost nobody is able to survive from, and she's done it twice. So I have no doubt that she will. And look, she's a fighter. She is determined, and I think, you know, I think we haven't seen the last of her. I don't think she's going anywhere. So God speed to her. So
I hope when you were in law school, did they mention her much, or the Supreme Court cases, justices, and all, or no?
Not that I have a specific recollection of.
I just wonder, you know,
yeah.
Because I'm not the one that went to law school here.
obviously some really significant decisions at the Supreme Court over a period of time, especially dealing with civil rights, and a multitude of justices involved with that. But, you know, I think what's always interesting about the Supreme Court is everybody thinks, you know, everybody is just so assumes that the court is so split by ideological lines, and it's really not. When you look at the majority of cases and you look at these where they fall down, I mean, more often than not, people that you think are polar opposites are actually working together and ruling the exact same way. And so it's a very interesting, you know, I think the media portrays the court as one way, but I think even Justice Ginsburg, I think, you know, she respects her colleagues. You know, as we've talked about before, I think like Justice Scalia.
They were best friends. They were polar opposites in their view of the world. I mean, he was very conservative.
Their view of the interpretation of the Constitution,
right.
Like, and how they. But they had tremendous respect for each other and their approach to law and how they would work through things. So I just thought they were best friends. So I think that's when I do believe she's a fighter. I don't think she's going to go anywhere. And you know, she is obviously, you know, somebody that we idolize in the Jewish community. We're, you know, super proud of her and for what she's done. But speaking about the continual dialogue of, you know, civil rights and justice reform, I think, you know, so the fallout of Farrakhan's message on July 4th that was on Revolt TV, which is a cable channel that I didn't realize was owned by P. Diddy Combs, the rapper Sean Combs. And
really? I've never heard of Revolt TV, to be totally candid.
Because if you remember, Vox had dropped it. They said they weren't going to broadcast it. P. Diddy's like, well, I'll pick it up, and he put it on Revolt TV. Of course, YouTube took it down for hate speech after about a million views, but it was already out there, right? So we talked about Deshaun Jackson and others last week, and then, you know, but it continued. Like, sort of the spiral downwards continued this week, obviously, with Nick Cannon, who was also, you know, a Louis Farrakhan supporter, and he himself had shared a video of himself from several years ago, where he was talking with rapper Professor Griff, and they were sharing, you know, conspiracy theories about Jews, and the whole discussion about how Farrakhan talks about how I'm not an anti-Semite because they're not the real Semites.
Yeah,
it was the same thing that he said.
Yeah, I saw that too. Where do they come up with this, that we are the Semites? I mean, the Farrakhan and his followers, that is like so out of left field, it seems to me. But what I don't understand with Nick Cannon, is he fired or is he not? I have seen varying media stories, some saying he's fired from his TV shows, and others said, no, he apologized. Then he said Viacom owes him an apology.
It's very confusing. So what I think I have, because I try to do a timeline, because I was following when it first broke, and you know, from what I understand, he doubled down initially and refused to apologize, and he's like, I'm not apologizing for that. But after tremendous pushback, and I think it was after Viacom fired him, he then did issue a public apology for his anti-Semitic remarks. You know, and look, I think we all need to give him an opportunity to make right. I mean, he seems sincere. He spoke with, I think, Rabbi Abraham Cooper at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, you know, said that he felt ashamed of sharing those conspiracy theories. And you know, we could only hope that, he, you know, including just comments about the Rothschilds going into, you know, all these theories about how the Rothschilds and the Jews control centralized banking and et cetera. I mean, I think, you know, sharing that clip was harmful. And the fact that initially he wouldn't apologize for it and sort of doubled down was really troubling. But ultimately he finally did. And what was interesting on this is I applaud, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, yeah. Let's give a big shout out to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Yeah.
He is such a hero, and you know, he came out so strong because he was so upset by what he was seeing. And you know, he's a journalist now, and he's been writing for The Hollywood Reporter and others for years now, and he got so frustrated with what he was seeing as far as the silence, in essence, from sports figures and Hollywood figures. And he sort of took to the page and he wrote, and I quote, he said, after all, if it's okay to discriminate against one group of people by hauling out cultural stereotypes without much pushback, it must be okay to do the same to others. Illogic begets illogic. Recent incidents of anti-Semitic tweets and posts from sports entertainment celebrities are a very troubling omen for the future of the Black Lives Matter movement. But so too is a shocking lack of massive indignation, he wrote. He said, given the new wokefulness in Hollywood and in the sports world, we expected more public outrage. And what we got was a shrug of meh rage. And he goes on, and I love what he says. He says, listen, at the end of the day, what we need to learn is that no one is free until everyone's free. And then he continued to quote from MLK Jr., and he said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. So let's act like it. If we're going to be outraged by injustice, let's be outraged by injustice against anyone. And I, you know, I'm so grateful that, you know, he came out with such a strong statement, as did several others in the community. Jamil Hill did as well. She's also a sports journalist, as well as like, the ladies on The View. I mean, I think this was just...
Yeah.
It's important because, you know, if we're all trying to fight for justice now, you know, we can't be silent and turn a blind eye or even get behind and support statements like this. Like, P. Diddy Combs and others supported Nick Cannon's statement. You know, they didn't want him to apologize. And even Ice Cube, when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar released his statement this week, you know, Ice Cube released a statement. He said, shame on the Hollywood Reporter who obviously gave my brother Kareem 30 pieces of silver to cut us down without even a phone call, the rapper tweeted. I mean...
Well, let me tell you. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has more cachet than any of the rappers around.
I mean,
he is a man of peace. He's an intellectual. He's not a bad actor. Remember him in Airplane?
I don't remember him there. I just know him as an NBA player.
Oh, no. He, Airplane was one of those goofy movies. He was one of the pilots or co-pilots. Very, very, very funny. Anyhow, that's on the side. But okay, so you've done a timeline. Does Nick Cannon have a job or does he not have a job?
He does. Okay, so I don't think... Okay, so as far as I understand, he hasn't been welcomed back to Viacom, but he is continuing as... He's employed by Fox
it's one of those talent shows. I thought he left that. I thought he left that to do some other reality show. But he does.
So he has a couple things. So I understood that I haven't seen anything where he's been invited back to Viacom, but I did see where he had
whatever he's doing on Fox. Okay.
Right, that he was still doing it, and but look, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt that his recent apology was sincere and that he is beginning to understand. And this goes back to that whole, you know, our conversation we've been having. I think that it's important to have these dialogues now, first of all, to call it out when we see it, and then also, you know, show mercy and give people an opportunity, because I think a lot of times there have been a lot of stereotypes out there, and maybe they just haven't heard anything different, or maybe that's, you know, I think it's just important that we, you know, so I'm, I forgive him, I'm like, no, and we'll see if he changes his ways. I do want to say this, though. Mike, there was a great piece. I think this is in the Jerusalem Post. Yeah, it's in the Jerusalem Post. So this is written by an imam. This is an Iranian-born imam, Mohammad Talidi. He actually wrote an op-ed piece related to this, you know, as far as celebrities and others promoting anti-Semitism. And it's a great piece. I think it was published on July 15th. I'd encourage people to look at it again. It's Mohammad Talidi and the Jerusalem Post. But you know, just from his perspective as a Muslim cleric, just saying, wait a second, you know, this is wrong. You know, we need to speak out. We can't be silent when we see these anti-Semitic conspiracies. And I think it's, and this is part of, we all, in culture, we all need to support each other. We all need to be a voice.
And you know, particularly we've talked about it a lot, the African-American community and the Jewish community, which we will get into in an interview we have coming up a little bit later on in the show. We were so together for so long. Somehow we got separate. We need to bring it back together. Speaking of anti-Semitism and closer to home, disgusting incident in Sarasota where two synagogues were desecrated in Sarasota with swastikas, and it was Temple Sinai in Sarasota and Temple Emmanuel were both, and they think it's the same guy that did both. They've got him on, I guess, security cameras or something.
They have lots of video footage, so I think they've released that and they're looking for him. I think this is the one of the two synagogues had been vandalized.
I think Temple Emmanuel. I think it was the second time for them. Yeah, that is really frightening, disgusting, and people in Sarasota, I'm happy to say, have risen up, Jewish and non-Jewish people in the community, saying, "Man, we cannot tolerate this in our community. It's just so wrong." You know,
it's a reminder that it's in our backyard.
It is.
Right? I mean, it's. This is happening every day around us, and we just...
Last night, as again I said, we're taping this on Friday, Rachel Maddow had an explosive interview with Mary Trump, and who said that her uncle Donald regularly used the N-word and use tropes about Jewish folks, which makes you wonder when his son-in-law is Jewish and his wife converted to Judaism, but this was long before that happened. We've got a clip of that, but it's disappointing. But this is Rachel Maddow and Mary Trump.
Let me ask you, Mary, about something that you said in an interview with the Washington Post this week. You talked with Ashley Parker at the Washington Post And you said there was, she's quoted you saying there was knee-jerk anti-Semitism, knee-jerk racism in your family. The Post quotes you as saying, growing up, it was sort of normal to hear them use the N-word or use anti-Semitic expressions. I just wanted you to expand on that. Do you mean just generally within the family that was an accepted thing, or do you mean specifically you heard your Uncle Donald use this, that kind of language?
Just generally, with the older generations, as if it were perfectly commonplace and ordinary to say such things. I had the benefit of living in Jamaica, not Jamaica Estates, and going to school in Forest Hills. So I didn't share their ideas about race and Judaism at all. But, you know, when you grow up with that being perfectly normal, then you don't really think twice about it.
I have to press you on it a little bit, just to ask if the president, if your uncle was an exception to that in your family, or if he, if you ever heard him express either use anti-Semitic slurs or the N-word or other racist slurs or other sentiments like that, was it, or do you mean this was an ambient thing in your family, but you can't say that you ever heard it from him, or did you hear it from him too?
Oh yeah, of course I did. And I don't think that should surprise anybody, given how virulently racist he is today.
Have you heard the president use the N-word?
Yeah.
And anti-Semitic slurs specifically?
Yes.
So, one of the things that really also hit me this week was there was a story about the president saying that rich billionaires are helping, Jewish billionaires are helping steal the election from him.
So I got to say this. So I went and I read the article, and you know, it's interesting because the caption and some of the articles say that, you know, rigged the election with money from Jewish billionaires, but it's not what the president said. He just said, the Democrats are trying to rig the November election, but he did not. And then the quotations end. He didn't. And then they go on and say, with money from three billionaires.
I know. I read a quote somewhere where he said three rich Jewish billionaires.
Because I'm reading the article and the quotes aren't around those words. And I just thought, you know, I mean, look, I would say his comment about Tom Steyer and others. You know, he's focusing on Steyer, which.
Steyer's not even Jewish. His father was Jewish, but he doesn't practice Judaism. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. But the point is Steyer's been very public. I mean, he was publicly financing the impeachment. He was all about the impeachment. I mean, I think attacking Steyer is no different than attacking Koch.
No, listen. I have no problem with him attacking Steyer or Bloomberg for that matter. But I have a problem attacking them because they're Jewish or that they have Jewish sympathy. I mean, you can attack them and say, I don't like him. He tried to fund the impeachment, blah, 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 blah. Stop it there. But the moment he says...
I'm with you. I just didn't see anywhere where that was quoted. Like, in the articles I've read, they start talking about that, but then the quotes aren't around the word Jewish ever. And I thought, so I would caution that. I think we need to look at that because I don't know that he actually said that. I mean, that would be a pretty dumb thing for him to say.
Well, Laureen, that's not a good defense. That's not a good defense of the president to say that he might have said a dumb thing.
But what I'm trying to do is make sure that we're not...
No, and I agree.
I think that's a really key issue there, because I've seen a couple of headlines on it, but then when I actually read the language of the articles, I didn't see quotes around that. And, you know, for Mary, you know, I think it's sad that she's attacking her grandfather, Fred, and others. I mean, I think every family has, you know, drama. I don't know a single family that does.
Every family is dysfunctional. It just depends how dysfunctional they are.
Right.
But here, the White House was asked about that quote, that allegation, and they said her book is full of lies. But that was never in the book. It was just something, she's been doing interviews about the book, that she brought up, and they never refuted that allegation. They talked about the book, but they didn't talk about that allegation.
But you know what? It doesn't mean that her grandfather Fred didn't say stuff like that. I mean, you don't know. I mean, you don't know. I mean, she's talking about her old, you know, this family, this old, you know, bunch of old guys, conservative. Like, I mean, so I, you know, and unfortunately, her dad and other people aren't around to defend themselves. But it's, you know, so I always hate that. I don't like to throw family business around. I find families can be their worst critics sometimes,
it's newsworthy. It's concerning.
Listen, it's definitely newsworthy.
You know, it just goes back to the whole thing in Charlottesville when he said there are good people on both sides and that the folks were saying Jews will not replace us. I mean, there you could put together a case, maybe circumstantial case, but if you were in court, knowing the type of lawyer I bet you are, you could put together a case that might convince a jury, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, but, yeah. And honestly, you know, being a good lawyer as I am, I could put together a case that can go either way.
Either way, absolutely. absolutely.
And I think too.
Yes. I am sure of that. Okay.
I want to talk about Barry White.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, you believe it or not.
The New York Times, which we have been talking about for a while, and if our listeners recall, maybe a month ago or so, that there was an op-ed piece from Senator Cotton that got pulled. But there was all this controversy, and in essence...
No, it didn't get pulled. It ran. It didn't get pulled. It ran. Cotton's piece ran.
Right, it ran, but then they pulled it. Like, New York Times pulled it after it had ran. Like, they pulled off their website and whatever.
So yeah, but I mean, okay. But it still was out there. Right.
Yeah, but it was out there. But what happened was the controversy, it's not about Cotton. It was more about... employees at other reporters, employees at New York Times, you know, began to boycott, saying we're not coming to work. And then what happened is it just sort of spiraled and snowballed into this massive, you know, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory where they started pointing fingers at, like, the three Jewish writers for the New York Times, Barry Weiss, Brett Stevens, and then the other young guy whose name I apologize, I can't remember, but they're, like, all pointing fingers at them and attacking them. And it took almost a week before the editor-in-chief came to their defense. And so Barry this week finally resigned from the New York Times. Now, Barry herself considers, I believe she's a Democrat and she's a centrist. This is what she said. But she was really angry with what was going on the paper. And she has been there for about 3 years. And she said, and I quote, she said, instead, a new consensus has emerged in the press, but perhaps especially at this paper, the truth isn't a process of collective discovery, but an orthodoxy already known to an enlightened few whose job is to inform everyone else. I certainly can't square how you and other Times leaders have stood by while simultaneously praising me in private for my courage, she added. Showing up for work as a centrist at an American newspaper should not require bravery. Intellectual curiosity, let alone risk-taking, is now a liability of the Times. So she, in essence, left because she said that she was being bullied regularly by her colleagues and her fellow coworkers.
Yeah, but the question is, was it because of her political views that were not as progressive as the Times purports to be, or because she was Jewish, or a combination of the two? I mean, it's not crystal clear to me where the bullying came from, and it might have been a combination of both.
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, look, you know, she made a comment in the piece with Altemeyer about how they would look at her and sort of make comments about, oh, you're writing about the Jews again, you know.
Right.
For those of you who don't recall, she wrote the book in 2019. Mike and I had talked about it on the show last year. She had authored the book How to Fight Anti-Semitism, which is a powerful book, a very smart piece. But I would say it's actually a combination of both. I mean, I think it's concerning that the three, you know, Jews are being specifically singled out at the New York Times. I think it raises a lot of red flags. It shouldn't, there's no reason why Barry Weiss, who's a very articulate, intelligent, and a powerful writer, should not be able to find a place at the largest paper in the nation.
I agree. This may surprise you, though, because I read all sorts of journalism blogs and commentary and all. there was some criticism of her for walking away, and not, she lashes out at certain people with powerful columns, and some of the journalism critics have said, well, she can dish it out, but she can't take it. I don't agree with that, but I just want you to know that not everybody in the journalistic world, even those who criticized the New York Times, agreed with her decision, which I thought was sort of interesting.
Yeah, so. But, you know, I think it's hard, you know, and it's also hard because none of us are there. We don't know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bullying she's receiving on it, you know, from her colleagues. But, you know, you shouldn't feel uncomfortable going to the office like you're hated.
No. I'm not saying I agree with that. But I just want you to know that in some of the journalism blogs that I read on a regular basis, it wasn't a unanimous, go Barry, you did the right thing. So here's one that's sort of close to home but halfway around the world. The head of CENTCOM, Kenneth McKenzie, yes, said that Hezbollah would be making a big mistake if it tried to start any hostilities with Israel. And
I hope that's true.
I know. Well, yes. And CENTCOM, for those who don't know, is located at MacDill Air Force Base. That's where Schwarzkopf was stationed and all. And I have been in the war room twice. This is really, it's unbelievable. I was there once when Queen Elizabeth was here, and they took her in there,
really?
And they allowed us in there. And once when Donald Rumsfeld, when he was Secretary of Defense, was here, and they allowed us in. And they have a board that goes an entire wall long that shows the movement of every troop in the Middle East.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's like out of a movie.
Only one time.
Yeah, it was like out of a movie. But to have CENTCOM, that's not just that it would be a mistake because Israel will decimate you. I thought that was a veiled threat, like, you want to take on CENTCOM, buddy? Yeah, go ahead. See what happens to you. I was very pleased to hear him say that. I thought that was a really strong iron fist comment by Kenneth McKenzie.
Yeah, and I will say this. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you don't just make a statement like that out of the blue.
No. Yeah.
I mean, and we all know that Iran has been, you know, obviously funding Hezbollah. They've been very actively moving around throughout Lebanon. You know, they've got almost, I think it's almost 300 rockets now in Lebanon pointed at Israel. They've been building facilities throughout Lebanon for the, what do you call it, specifically for guided missiles. So they've been working on the technology for guided missiles, which makes it even more dangerous. So, you know, they can attack Israel and target schools, government office buildings, you know, infrastructure, and it's really serious.
They are bad actors.
Exactly. And Iran continues to pretty much take over Syria. I mean, people don't appreciate the fact that Iran is all over Syria. You know, they pretty much run the country. It's not Bashar anymore. And they are horrible actors. I think, you know,
and
anyway,
weren't they? Wait. Speaking of missiles, though, wait. We can't pass this up. Speaking of missiles, didn't Israel find 28 missile launching sites in Beirut that Hezbollah had put together?
Right. So that exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they and these
and these were in civilian areas. These were in civilian areas, right?
Oh, absolutely. They're even on the border. So Israel's northern border on the northwest side is with Lebanon, and the northeast side is with Syria. I mean, even there on the border at schools and playgrounds in homes, they've got rocket launchers and missile launchers. And so one of the things that Hezbollah's been doing is they've been increasing the number of missile launch sites throughout the country, not just on the southern border.
Mm.
And a lot of these launch sites are within civilian populations, and that's why it's so dangerous. So if they decide they're going to launch, you know, 100,000 rockets at Israel tomorrow, the only way for Israel to defend itself would be to knock out those sites that are in
civilian areas, which is just terrible.
It's like, where is the outrage of humanity? Like, when you think about Hezbollah sitting here and putting the entire civilian population of this beautiful country, Lebanon, at risk. I just don't know. It's hard to understand.
Hey, let's do this. Let's take a break. We've got a great interview you did with Curtis Stokes. He was head of the NAACP here for a while. He's a businessman. He talks about Jews in the black community. It's really.
He was on the commission. Was he on the city commission?
He was the city council. City council. Tampa City Council. Yep. So let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with that interview. You are listening to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions.
That interview about the long-standing kinship between African Americans and Jews is coming right up. But I just want to remind you about all the ways you can support The Third Opinion. You can make a one-time donation. If you have a business or organization, you can spread the word through underwriting the show. Or you can become a member of the Third Opinion Podcast Founders Club. Head to our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com, to learn more. Now let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorraine Jaffe.
Let's talk a little bit about Curtis Stokes. You did a great interview with him. Set this up.
Yeah, I mean, just like, you know, so this is part of, you know, our dialogue as we, you and I, have been having guests on the show to talk about justice, as, you know, as a Jewish cause, as justice is a Jewish value, but also the need for reform in the criminal justice system. And then ways that we as Jews can begin to work with the black community. I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen. You know, somehow our community sort of rifted apart, but need to come back together because we're at a pivotal moment and we really need to be a voice for each other. And so it sort of reached out to Curtis as somebody who has been, you know, spent his life as an activist, really a businessman and an activist.
But interestingly, he didn't know Jewish people till he went to college.
Right.
Let's listen to him. Curtis Stokes. Here's Curtis Stokes.
You know, it's weird. I never knew who and what a Jewish person was until my junior year in college. I grew up in a small rural town in South Florida called Belgrade, and you were either black or white. And I just never had the concept of anything other beyond that. And it wasn't until my junior year in college, I met a guy named Dan Rosemark. Dan grew up in Lake Worth, Florida. And he and I were both in Florida Atlantic together. And you know, Dan shared to me, you know, he was Jewish. And I didn't know what that meant. I mean, pardon my ignorance, but I didn't know what that meant. So Dan and I became very, very good friends. And Dan and I are good friends to this day. And, you know, fast 4 years later, I met a guy who my training manager at Nations Bank, a guy named Mark Siegel. And Mark remains a very dear friend to this day as well. And but there's always been this kinship between African Americans and the people of the Jewish faith because we both had difficult points in our lives where you all had the Holocaust and we had the slave trade and slavery and Jim Crow here in the United States. And we both suffer the anti-Semitism and racist remarks to this day. You still have individuals who want to harm synagogues, and you still have individuals who want to harm, you know, the African-American community. But we've always had this kinship. And I think going forward, even after the George Floyd issue, I think we need to rekindle that. But I think the younger generation needs to hear about how we've always had that kinship between the Jewish community and the African-American community. And how we've always fought side by side to make things possible and make things right in the community for both of us. You know, I love to post Floyd, see younger members of the Jewish faith and younger African Americans get together in the room and figure out how we are going to do it differently in the future. So I'm excited about it. I think it can happen.
Yeah, I always say that there's, you know, the Jewish faith and the foundations of it, like justice is such a part of it, right? There's the command, the mitzvah, you're supposed to pursue justice and love mercy. And
And I think that's, you know, it's that's why you've seen, I think, so many times, and because Jews do understand what it's like to be discriminated against. I think that's why we've historically seen those, that kinder relationship. And
right, exactly.
But we do need to rekindle that and find ways that we can work together. And I think, you know, especially now, I think the Black community really, you know, needs us and needs a voice, and we need to do better at being that voice for our friends.
Sure.
And I think before we got on the recorded line, you and I had chatted a little bit. Sort of share some personal stories. I think every Jew listening to this show will, you know, has had some experience in their life of, you know, to their face, anti-Semitism. You know, I shared a story about me personally being called a dirty Jewish dog, and that's just randomly some person on the street who didn't even know me, you know. but I think you know, one thing people who see you, I mean, you are this extraordinarily successful businessman. You have held so many leadership roles in the community. Someone would look at you and might think, he's not subject to racism. You know, look at him, he's so successful and all these other things. And I think that's a very ignorant position.
Right. You know, Lauren, I beg to differ. It's always, for me, it's always been very subtle racism. I can remember, I think it was probably 20 years ago, or perhaps, a friend of mine had just got drafted by the New Orleans Saints. And he and I went to high school together. He and I were driving to New Orleans. And we're on one side of I-75, and the cops on the other side of I-75. If you know the road going north, you know there's a big field in between I-75 north and I-75 south. So he and I are going to New Orleans, and the police, we wasn't speeding. The police pulls up behind us and tell us that, you know, he's pulling us over because the music is too loud.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So he sat there and said, okay. You know, Jimmy had just got drafted by the New Orleans Saints, and, you know, I was a young guy. So we're both 21, 22 years old. And so we're both trying to understand it. But, you know, from our training, from the quote-unquote talk that we got from our parents, you know, we knew to keep our hands at 10 and 2 and not to say anything wrong, but just comply.
Right.
And, you know, we got to talk. And just about a month ago, a buddy of mine who's an orthopedic surgeon in town, same deal, profiled. He and I were stopped and said that the officer couldn't see the tag on the car. And he and I, you know, we're leaving a cigar bar where we drink smoking cigars. And he said that we couldn't see the tag on the car and pulled us over and, made us give him a license and all that. And, you know, after that, he let us go. But, you know, I've seen it, never overtly called the N-word to my face, but I've heard it. But, you know, my experience has always been not that in-the-face racism, but sort of the, subtle racism.
Right. It's interesting that you share that. I had a very close friend who is a managing partner of one of the largest law firms in the country, and he had shared a personal message in the Miami Herald about a week ago. And he's a very tall guy, very large, Black male. I mean, just truly one of the most genuine, you know, smart, kind people you'll ever meet. And he was sharing, you know, a similar story. You know, very aware of his color and his size. So even when he gets on an elevator, you know, he sort of stands back from people, you know, looks in the eyes, smiles. Like he has, like he feels like he has to do all of these things to be on the offensive, you know, and it's just sort of innate in what he does because he's aware of that sort of inherent subtle racism that exists out there.
Right.
And that's sort of, it's just, and when you hear this, it's so shocking that you have to change your whole lifestyle because of this.
You know, Charles Barkley wrote a book about 15 years ago called, it was titled, Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man? Right? And the book, in essence, is about, you know, personally, I'm 6'3", 230 pounds. I'm a tall guy. But you get that. And, you know, I had a young lady at work one time go to HR and say she was scared of me. You know?
Oh, God. And,
yeah. You know, for anyone that knows that I'm a big teddy bear, right? But you know, as a large African American guy, you know, I can't raise my voice. I can't be angry. I can't be agitated. I have to dress a certain way, because I always have to be, how do you say, non-threatening, right?
Right.
And it's interesting. It's very interesting.
You had the you had to have the talk. I heard you say that, you know, we had Pastor Michael Price on, and he talked about, and he's with Victory AME and is active mm-hmm. with the Hillsborough Organization for Progress and Equality. And, you know, he talked about the talk, you know, his dad gave him the talk, and he has a young son and a young daughter, and he has to give them the talk. And he's given them the talk and reminded them of the talk.
you know, my son's he's an athlete. He's a football player for Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, and you know, he has the long dreadlocks. Even though he went to a Jesuit high school, he still, you know, he still looks a little bit different than your typical high school kid, Jesuit high school kid. So he's at Florida A&M. He's playing football. You know, I get nervous whenever he's leaving Tallahassee. Coming back to camp or leaving camp or going back to Tallahassee. And you tell him, you know, don't drive with your wallet in your pocket. You know, leave, you know, if you ever get stopped by the police, put your hands at 10 and 2.
Yeah.
Don't argue. Make sure you is yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. You really have to have that talk with them and let them know that, you know, if you want to fight, we'll fight in court. But we're not going to fight it on the side of a highway.
Right.
And thank God, you know, he hasn't run into any issues yet. But you know, driving, you know, with the dreadlocks, and he looks like a suspect, if you will. But we've always had to have that talk with him and let him know that, you know, don't drive with your wallet in your pocket. Keep your hands at 10 and 10-2. Always yes sir, yes ma'am, no sir, no ma'am, and live to fight another day.
Yeah, I think these are really important conversations. So as we're moving forward as a nation, as a community, you know, looking at ways how we can heal and reform a criminal justice system that in many ways has tremendous disparate impact upon Black and Brown communities. There are tremendous inequalities that exist. And this is an example of one of those subtle ones that, you know, It's so important. You know, people need to sit around their table and go, okay, did I ever get this talk? Did we have to give this talk to our kids? No. You know, why do parents in this country have to give, why do Black parents have to give this talk to their children? This is not normal, and it shouldn't have to exist. So I think these are important conversations to have, you know, now that we're moving forward sort of in this post-George Floyd world of, you know, really getting together and understanding and how the Jewish community can come together and work with the Black community.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, we also talked a lot about criminal justice reform. We had State Attorney Andrew Warren on and going through a lot of the reforms that he was doing. And there are a handful of state attorneys around the country working on to get rid of a lot of these poverty traps that have disparate impact on Black and Brown communities. You know, concerning criminal justice reform specifically, you know, what are some of the steps you think we can do as a community and as a nation to begin to improve where we are and where we need to go?
Well, Lauren, I think, some suggestions I would have are, I think, you know, more community policing, I think before a police man or woman is thrust into a neighborhood, whether it's urban or suburban, is they spend at least 100 hours of community service within that neighborhood. That way they get to know who they're policing, and it makes it for an easier transition. I think we need B. I think that's a sensitivity training. I think that, you know, kids in urban and suburban communities should not be afraid to police, or are more apprehensive when they're approached by the police for a matter.
Mm-hmm.
That the adult, when you get the adults in the room and hash it out. You know, America has never really addressed the race issue. I mean, I think we talk about race too much in America, but then again, I don't think we talk about it enough. And I think the police are called too much for social issues, right? Mm-hmm. You call the police if you and your neighbors are having a spat over a fence, you call the police. You know, if the neighbor has a cat in the tree, you call the police. If Johnny down the street's riding a skateboard too fast down the road, you call the police. Those aren't police issues. Those are things where you go to Johnny's parents and tell them, you know, hey, Johnny's riding a skateboard recklessly down the street. Let's talk to him about that. Because I think we've militarized the police force. And you're giving them leftover military grade equipment, and they come out with a militaristic view when they come to the community. So I would say those are some things that we need to implement. And you know, when it comes to a African American Jewish relationship, I think the communities need to get together because we have to have a kinship in what we've shared in the past. That we don't want to ever happen again in this world, and there's some things that, you know, we need to get to the Jewish millennials and the African American millennials together, and see how we can solve the issue of race going forward.
That was a great interview, and what I thought was so important that we've had this conversation whenever we've had an African American male on is he talked about the conversation. That every
exactly.
African American family, every father talks to his son and maybe with daughters too, but more with sons about keep your hands on the wheel, be respectful to police. That is frightening. We don't have to do that. I mean, you tell your kids to be respectful and all, but it's a very different psyche if you have to do this because you're afraid that your son could get shot if they make a wrong
right.
move. That is just. It is mind-boggling.
And this is the thing, is that it's a fact of life in the black and brown communities. And I think, you know, and that's why we need to talk about it, so people can begin to understand and appreciate, because it shouldn't have to be that way. And we all need to begin to, you know, you can't have empathy and you can't show mercy and kindness unless you can begin to appreciate this. So, It's just knowing, you know, the shoes that someone else had to walk in. So really appreciate Curtis taking the time to be with us.
We have more of that interview. We'll play it in another couple of weeks, some more of that interview. Also, on the good front, there is some research being done in Israel on COVID that they say a drug that reduces cholesterol could be the cure, because some researcher has found that the lipids are going into the heart and the bloodstream of people who have COVID, and that it's an easily accessible drug that's been tested. It's fenofibrate. It's sold under the name of Tricor, but they think that this could be a way to cure this quickly. So that would
or dramatically reduce the symptoms. They say it helps inhibit COVID's ability to reproduce in the lungs, which obviously that's the issue, right? Is attacking the lungs.
Right.
So, you know, it's already an FDA approved treatment, but obviously just for cholesterol. So it'd be interesting to see what they could do here. I mean, look, there's so much progress being made on globally on the attack of COVID.
COVID. So hopefully we will get there and we'll
yeah.
have that.
Before we before we run out of time, I want to play this thing that to me is the bright spot
right.
of the week. You know, Hamilton has been so big. It's been on TV. There's a song called "You'll Be Back." There is a cantor at a bat mitzvah in New York named Ozzie Schwartz, and he did a version of a Don Alum that, well, you listen to it. This is cantor Ozzie Schwartz.
We don't know which direction you'll choose in your life, but one thing we're absolutely sure about, you'll be back. Oh, say, Shalom bimromav hu yaseh shalom aleinu. Oseh, shalom bimromav hu yaseh shalom aleinu. Ve'al kol, al kol Yisrael ve'al kol yoshvei tevel ve'imru amen. Adon Olam, Asher Malach, Terem Kol Yetir Yetir Nifra, Let Nasa, Chepto Kol, Adai Melech Shemo Nifra, Ve'acharei, Kichlot HaKol, Levado Yimloch Yimloch Nora, Ve'hu Aya, Ve'hu Ove, Ve'hu Iye, Adon Olam Asher Malach, da 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 da, da 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 Let Nasa be Hepsokor, Adai Mele Shemonikra, Beyado Akid Ruchi, Betishan Beahira, Beyin Ruchi, Geviati, Adonai Livelo, Velo. La la la.
I'll tell you, if that doesn't make you smile and be proud to be Jewish, I don't know what will. That was just.
And we'll all be singing it all day long. I thought it was adorable. It was just such a great, fun rendition.
And yeah. the video, go to YouTube and watch it because it's good to listen to again. But the little bat mitzvah girl, by the end, she's singing along. The congregation is singing along. If you're feeling low, if you're feeling upset about anything, listen to this. Watch it, and if you can't walk away smiling, there's something wrong with you.
Right?
Right? Right.
Exactly. It was a good piece. I'm glad you brought the Hollywood or all the songs.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. No. See, I'm the music maven. You're the documentary and the movie maven. But yeah, it just brightened my day. Lorene, believe it or not, you hear that music?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Well, we had a packed show. We're glad you're with us this week. I hope you come back and listen to us either on the podcast or on the radio. And this is The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Bye.
That's this week's Third Opinion. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion, you can get in touch with us at thirdopinionpodcast.com. And please subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.